Well, I tell you what, since we're a small group, before I begin, let me just have everybody introduce one another so that you're not just in and out. I'll tell you that I'm Darrell Bach. I'm research professor of New Testament studies at Dallas Theological Seminary, and I've taught there 22 years and did my doctoral work in Aberdeen, Scotland, and have done three sabbaticals in Tübingen in Germany, and I'm completing a sabbatical right now in Tübingen. So it's my third one. I've been working on a commentary on Acts to go with Luke that I did for Baker, and I've been working on a book on the missing Gospels for Thomas Nelson that will come out about the time of the Da Vinci Code movie to deal with some of the issues that book is raising, the extra-biblical Gospels and a comparison between the extra-biblical Gospels and the New Testament Gospels. So that's who I am. My assignment today is to discuss the Jesus Seminar. People keep asking, is the Jesus Seminar very active? And the answer to the question is, the work of the Jesus Seminar is done. But people who work with the Jesus Seminar continue to write and publish on a regular basis. They're turning out books on a regular basis. Although in many cases, they've moved their attention, in some cases, to Paul. There was a Paul Seminar that followed this, that analyzed the work of Paul. There was a seminar that worked with the book of Acts, and they're going to turn their attention to the canon. That's where they're going next. So that gives you a little bit of the history. And I will explain both what the seminar has attempted to do and evaluate it in this hour, and hopefully there'll be plenty of time for questions. Let's see here. I'm working with someone else's machine. What is the Jesus Seminar? The Jesus Seminar is a group of New Testament scholars working together to reach a consensus as to what Jesus really said as opposed to the words that have been attributed to Jesus by the later tradition. It is an assumption of the Jesus Seminar that the Christ of faith and the Jesus of history are not the same. Perhaps more importantly, it is an assumption that words have been put into Jesus' mouth to one degree or another. And so over several years, the seminar met to evaluate the individual sayings of Jesus running through not just the canonical Gospels, this is important, but also the Gospel of Thomas. Because another value of the Jesus Seminar is that the Gospel of Thomas is a reflection of independent and early tradition about Jesus, something that most scholars don't accept. We'll talk about that later. In this picture is, over here on the left, is Daryl Schmidt, who teaches a religion at TCU, who I'm very familiar with. Because we're both in the Fort Worth area, oftentimes the media will call one of us to ask about Jesus questions, and then when they're done, the media always has a question that says, who can we get who reflects the other side of the question? And we now have a thing where we say, well, you need to talk to the other Daryl, because his name and mine are the first names are the same. Anyway, that's Daryl Schmidt. I don't know who the other two gentlemen are, but I'll show you some pictures of some of the other key players here in a second. What's behind the Jesus Seminar? Well, behind the Jesus Seminar is the West Star Institute of Sonoma, California. It's the sponsor of the Jesus Seminar. They have their own website, the WestStarInstitute.org. And the chief organizer of the West Star Institute is Robert Funk, who is the founder of the Institute, who is the Funk of the Blas de Bruner Funk Greek grammar that some of you may be familiar with, and was a former president of the Society of Biblical Literature, is a disgruntled former evangelical. He grew up in an evangelical home. And as it's been, I think I've heard, this is the third story I've heard about this in the last 24 hours involving three different figures. Sometimes the major people who are opposed to evangelicalism are people who have reacted to it or against it in their lifetime, and Robert Funk is no exception. That's Robert Funk. That's John Dominic Crossan. John Dominic Crossan is a former co-chair of the Jesus Seminar. He's probably the most prolific writer from the seminar on issues either related to the seminar or related to the historical Jesus. He used to teach at a school in the Chicago, Illinois area. He's now retired. I've done several sessions with him at various settings in which he represents one side and I have represented the other. Very good, skilled communicator, very effective communicator, very clear in his presentation. and an interesting fellow who grew up in the Catholic Church. Who belongs to the Jesus Seminar? Well, it originally started with 30 fellows who were professional scholars who worked in the New Testament area. They weren't necessarily Jesus specialists, but some of them were. The membership grew to about 74 fellows and 100 associates. An associate is a way of describing someone who's an interested non-specialist. Many are well-known New Testament scholars. Crossan certainly is well-known. Funk is certainly well-known, and there are many others who are a part of the group. A few were evangelicals. I have a couple of friends who participated. One was Robert Stein, a name you may recognize, who teaches... who taught until recently at Southern Seminary. He participated for a while and then said he saw the way the thing was structured and withdrew. And then another friend of mine, a friend named Robert Webb, who I'm working together on a project for IBR, for the Institute for Biblical Research on the Historical Jesus, he has hung in to the very end. He stayed to the very end. Original purpose: to compile a list of all the words, canonical or not, attributed to Jesus in the first three centuries. That was the first part of what they wanted to do. So first, figure out what Jesus is attributed or is said to have said. Then to determine by consensus which of these words were probably from Jesus and which were later. The goal of the seminar is to popularize the results of these deliberations. I will tell you one reason why I have an appreciation for the seminar in this sense. They are honest about what they're doing. Many people who work in these areas are not completely honest about what they're doing as Jesus scholars. This group is completely honest about what they're doing. They are saying very clearly that things that are attributed to Jesus, he did not say, and we believe that. And there's no equivocation on that. Their goal is to popularize the results of these deliberations, and their goal in their written materials is to bring outside the ivory towers what has been what they claim to be well known in scholarly circles to the public square. And to the extent that they have gotten the attention of the media, at least in the United States, not so much in Europe, they were marginally successful in the United States getting people's attention because they were highlighted in all the news magazines, etc. From a PR standpoint, and Robert Funk had been a publisher previously, so he understood how this worked, he was very able to get the message into the public square. Thus, to make the general public aware of current New Testament research. That's the stated goal of the seminar. Here's a quote, from the Five Gospels. The Five Gospels, their most important book, publicizing the results of the seminar, is called the Five Gospels. Now, that means you're all going to have to redesign your Sunday school classes. That means Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Thomas. And here's what they say. The Five Gospels represents a dramatic exit from windowless studies, the closed ivory tower, and the beginning of a new venture for gospel scholarship. Leading scholars, fellows of the Jesus Seminar, have decided to update and then to make the legacy of 200 years of research and debate a matter of public record. Now, one of the things that I did in my Luke commentary for Baker was to go through all the passages in Luke that are discussed in this book, in the Five Gospels, and analyze it in a section that was set aside for criticism. So I have worked in detail with the comments of this book. Here are a series of publications. You may not realize it, but they've actually produced quite a lot of literature. And this is just a sample. This isn't all of it. The Parables of Jesus, the Gospel of Mark. In fact, it's in the book publication, The Gospels of Mark, that they first stated their principles. The Sayings Gospel, a work on Q. The Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Matthew, the Gospel of Luke, and the Gospel of John. And obviously, they first went through the individual Gospels and then collated it all together into the Five Gospels. The Five Gospels was published, I believe, in 1991. The Acts of Jesus and the Gospel of Jesus. Their method. The scholars voted on sayings using colored beads, and then they took the totals and then through mathematical formulas rated, R-A-T-E-D, rated the sayings in the following manner. Red, that's Jesus. That's exactly what Jesus said, verbatim. pink. Sure sounds like Jesus. Here they're saying they're not sure it's the exact words of Jesus, but it's something very, very close to what Jesus would have said. It is a very, very good paraphrase, if you will. Gray. Well, maybe. This may be Jesus' ideas, and thus it might be Jesus' teaching, but it may not be his exact words. So it's something slightly less than a paraphrase. It could be an explanation from a gospel writer bringing out the elaboration of what Jesus said or something to that effect. Black. There's been some mistake. Okay, something's wrong. Jesus didn't say that at all. I lost the sound on that when I switched computers, which is a shame. Anyway, so black means Jesus didn't say this at all. Now I'm going to give you some percentages so you can see what the results are. Well, first we'll talk about working premises. The Jesus Seminar has published its working premises, and it's a long list of things. Some of these premises we could agree with, some we would disagree with, some we would reject entirely, in other words, completely wrong, and others we might have questions about. When I say some of these we would disagree with, it might depend on what the actual premise means, as opposed to being sure that we disagree with them. Okay, there are 64 numbered premises and 7, now notice this, pillars of scholarly wisdom. Who wants to be against a pillar of scholarly wisdom? Do you? I mean, if you're against it, what are you, a pillar of scholarly foolishness? So you can see how they're working with language here. What follows is a sample. And the numbering of the premises follows the work in the Gospel of Mark, pages 2 to 26. So if you ever want to run this down, you can find their materials directly. They lay this all out very straightforwardly in this material. Yes.
The Roman numerals, are these the pillars of scholarly wisdom?
Yeah, those are, and they are from the 5 Gospels, okay? So the numbering of the premises comes from the Gospel of Mark, and the Roman numerals comes from the 5 Gospels. 2 different collections of premises, spread out over a period of, I think, slightly over 5 years. Some premises we could agree with, and if you want to, I tell you what, since we're so small and I'm running through these in pretty good shape, if you want to stop me as I go, feel free to raise a hand and interrupt me.
Darryl?
Yes.
Mentioned earlier that these guys were honest. Can you give me an example of somebody who wasn't honest?
Well, I think what you, oh yes, no problem. I'm supposed to repeat the question, and the question is, can you give me an example of someone who isn't honest? I think there are examples of scholars who aren't clear about what they mean when they say, well, we're a Christian, we respect the Bible, we think this is a reflection of perhaps the type of thing Jesus could or would have said, but, you know, these guys are very clear. Jesus didn't say that. Jesus taught his disciples orally. Jesus wrote nothing. Now, unless I'm really missing it, I suspect all of us could accept this premise, that Jesus taught his disciples orally, that the basic culture was an oral culture, and that as far as we know, we don't have anything that Jesus wrote directly that came directly from his pen. Okay? If there's anyone who disagrees, I feel like I should be at a wedding, you know. If anyone knows why this union should not take place, speak up now or forever hold your peace. Okay? 6. Jesus' mother tongue was Aramaic. The Gospels were written in Greek. Now, this is important for a variety of reasons. It means that most of what Jesus said, it's already being translated when we come to the Gospels. Okay, that's the underlying feature of this. Now, many people will acknowledge that Jesus it's conceivable that Jesus was bilingual, that he could have spoken more than Aramaic, and that some people in this part of the world during this time could well have been bilingual. That's possible. But the premise is that most discussions taking place between Jewish people would have happened in a Semitic language, in a Semitic context, and would have evolved the general Semitic language of the time, which was Aramaic. So that's the assumption that's working with there. So we're already in translation. The point is, we're already in translation when we hit the biblical Gospels. Most of this is straightforward. If you've had seminary training, this won't surprise you. More. Mark was written before Matthew and Luke, along with many people who work in New Testament studies. Many evangelicals also accept the fact that Mark is the first gospel and that Matthew and Luke came later. Now, in evangelical circles, there are some who still hold to a form of Matthean priority, just as in New Testament circles, Bill Farmer and others who aren't conservatives also hold to a form of Matthean priority. So that is a minority position to hold a Matthean priority. But many hold that Mark is first, and many evangelicals hold that Mark is first. And, for example, at Dallas, I think everyone but one of us holds to Mark being the first gospel that was written. Luke and Matthew shared a similar source of Jesus' teaching, which is popularly known as Q. This is a collection of teaching where Luke and Matthew overlap. It is strictly a teaching source for the most part. It's about 200 verses of overlap between Luke and Matthew that's very similar. The premise behind Q, there are two premises behind Q. The first is that Mark is the first gospel. And the second is, just as important, that Matthew and Luke did not know each other. So if Matthew and Luke did not know each other, and Mark is the first gospel, and Matthew and Luke have 200 verses of overlap, where did that common material come from? Okay? And Q is what is posited. Now, it is discussed and debated whether Q is one single written source, whether it's a form of oral tradition between the churches that Luke and Matthew both had access to, that kind of thing. I'm not stating a particular position here, nor does the seminar necessarily take a particular position here. But the idea of the existence of Q is a premise that they talk about that many evangelicals also will share. Ancient oral culture is not like modern print-based culture. Okay? This has to do with how the gospel tradition was transmitted. We don't have Xerox machines. We don't have printing presses. So how was the material passed on? It was passed on orally. There are two models for how this is done, two basic models. This is a little bit of an oversimplification, but we only have an hour. On the one hand, there's the model put forward by people like Bultmann, who wrote a comprehensive work on the synoptic gospel tradition that highlights the fluidity of the oral tradition and uses the model of Icelandic folklore as one of the means by which to assess how oral tradition was communicated from setting to setting and from generation to generation. On the other hand, you have a model that's highlighted by people who've studied Jewish rabbinics that talks about the way in which the oral tradition has been passed on. Rainer Riesner from Tübingen is an example of someone who's worked with this tradition. It goes back to what's called the Scandinavian school of Gerhardsen and Riesenfeld. And they argue for a controlled communication of oral tradition from generation to generation, where things were carefully passed on. So you've got kind of a loose model and a tighter model, if you will, that's out there. But everyone has agreed, I think, that for the most part, the Jesus tradition, before it was written down and encapsulated in the Gospels, circulated mainly in an oral manner. This is coming back into attention now. Jimmy Dunn has written a book called Jesus Remembered that was written in 2003 for Erdmans. And he is saying that New Testament scholars have not taken the oral culture enough seriously. And there's a whole tradition of discussion about oral culture that predates this. Kenneth Bailey has written a book on Jesus' parables that discusses this. He uses the model of how oral tradition has been passed on in Bedouin culture in the Middle East, currently as a model for this. Also a kind of controlled communication of oral tradition as you pass it down. But this is a premise that basically evangelicals, I think, would recognize as well. Jesus possibly spoke Greek as a second language. I've already mentioned that one. Jesus was itinerant. He moved around and adapted his sayings and parables to the occasion. This is important because it means that certain pieces of material that may be repeated may not necessarily belong to the same setting. If Jesus is itinerant and he's preaching and things are being passed on orally, there's no guarantee that that oral strand of the same story necessarily belongs to the same moment. Okay, so that's an important premise. Now, what the seminar does with this is not only does he adapt his sayings to the occasion, but the early church does to a significant degree as well. Some premises we might disagree with. 40 years elapsed after the death of Jesus before the first canonical gospel was composed. Again, I say we might because some evangelicals will put the bulk of the Gospels, including Mark, at or around AD 70 as the earliest Gospel, in which case it is right around 40 years. People date the crucifixion either at 30 or 33. Those are the two most popular dates for Jesus' crucifixion. But a lot of evangelicals will put Mark earlier. They'll put Mark in the early 60s, sometimes in the early 40s, if you're in the late 50s. Some people who hold a Matthean priority will put Matthew very early. I know people, evangelicals, who put Matthew in the late 40s, early 50s. That's unusual. But there are some evangelicals who hold that. So we might or might not accept that 40-year gap. Many conservative scholars would say the interval is closer to 30 years, and I think that's where the bulk of evangelical conservative scholars are, is that Mark would be the first gospel and you would put it somewhere in the early 60s. Other premises we would disagree with: the Gospel of Thomas represents an earlier stage of the tradition than do the canonical gospels. Now, this is probably one of the most important points in the Jesus Seminar. I'm going to get up and draw a diagram to show you what difference this makes. Remember that we've said that most people put Mark first. I'm going to change colors. That's too light. They'll put Mark first as the first gospel, and then you'll have Q, and then you'll usually have Matthew, and then you'll have Luke. And what often happens in historical Jesus discussions is material that comes out of Mark and Q is given a higher degree of reliability, talking historically critically now in historical Jesus discussions, while Matthew and Luke are given less weight. And this is usually abbreviated with M and L. And what we have here are a lot of actions of Jesus, and what we have here is a lot of teaching from Jesus. And then, of course, we get a mix, an M and L. Now, what the Jesus Seminar wants to do is they want to do this. We'll put Mark here. Most of them will acknowledge that Mark is still the earliest. And then generally they'll put Thomas here, 50s and 60s period. And I'll tell you why that's important in a second. Then they'll put Q, and then they'll go M, L, and of course John here is at the bottom. I didn't put John in, but I should. Okay. Yes, you'd slide all this down, and Mark and Thomas would come at right about the same time. Okay, so yeah, again, to repeat the observation, the question was, isn't Mark put later in the Jesus Seminar? Yes, it's right around the 70s, and Thomas is coming in the middle portion of the first century as well. So you slash these. Now, why is this important? This is important because of the nature of Thomas. Thomas is a teachings gospel. Okay? It's like Q in that it summarizes Jesus' teachings. Okay? Not only that, it tends to highlight Jesus as the revealer of wisdom. There's very little Christology in Thomas. Now, let me just tell you right now that it's often claimed there's no Christology in Thomas. That's not correct. Just remember saying 77, okay? Saying 77 in Thomas talks about the unique authority that Jesus has. It's the one text that discusses Christology. It's there, okay? It's not much, but it's there. Anyway, so they often say there's no Christology. That's wrong, okay? There's little Christology. So what we get out of Thomas is Jesus as a teacher of wisdom and not the figure at the center of the plan of God. This leads to another declaration, and that declaration is that there were alternative expressions of Christianity in the first century. One of which presented Jesus in this kind of deified direction, where the Messiah became Lord, or the Messiah became Son of God. Some books even reflect this title in the way they talk about it, from Christ to Lord. There are books about the historical Jesus that have that kind of a title. In contrast to this, there was this alternative Christianity that just presented Jesus as the one who revealed the way to God, who told us who we really were in ourselves, highlighting the idea that it's proper knowledge about who we are before God that is the way to salvation, themes that show up in the Gospel of Thomas. So by attempting to move Thomas early, the result is a situation in which the argument is you've got competing Christianities very early on. And this is a variation of the Bauer thesis that there was no such thing as orthodoxy in the first century, which I talked about yesterday in the Da Vinci seminar. Okay, is that clear? Okay. Now, here's an important fact. Most scholars, not just conservative scholars, believe the Gospel of Thomas to be early second century. Okay? This move up the scale is one of the moves the seminar made that most New Testament scholars working with historical Jesus materials do not accept. Now, I need to qualify this in one way, and that is there is discussion whether within Thomas there might be some sayings that are early and that go back to this period. That's different, however, from saying the entire gospel belongs to this period and the theology reflected in that gospel as a whole belongs to this period. Okay, so that's an important distinction. More likely, as I've said, the Gospel of Thomas is early second century. More premises. The Gospel of Thomas represents an independent witness to the Jesus tradition. This is debated. The fact is, this is highly debated. Some people see the Gospel of Thomas as a whole very much reflecting reflection on the Gospels, on the Gospel tradition, including John. Not just the Synoptics. Others think it is an independent witness. Some would argue some sayings may be independent. Okay, so you got three different positions, basically, in relationship to Thomas's relationship. But most scholars, I think it's fair to say, think the gospel as a whole is either late or at best only has a few independent sayings. Very few are arguing it's a genuine, complete, independent witness all on its own. Gospel of Thomas draws on the canonical Gospels. This is the most common view, but with a Gnostic twist in most sayings. Some sayings, however, could be independent. Some premises we would reject outright. The historical Jesus is not to be equated with the Christ of faith. Okay? I think, generally speaking, evangelicals see a conjunction between the historical Jesus and the Christ of faith. Now, we'll need to talk about this, and I'm going to talk about it by what I'm going to do when I evaluate it. But, generally speaking, there is a very close relationship between the historical Jesus and the Christ of faith. Second, the Synoptic Gospels are more historical than the Gospel of John. In other words, the Gospel of John is not a source for information about the historical Jesus. Now, in making this move, generally speaking, the seminar is closer to where a lot of New Testament scholars are. Most New Testament scholars tend to view John as a reflective gospel about Jesus as opposed to being directly in touch with him. Because of the difference in the way Jesus presents himself, he's more explicit in his connection to the Father and those kinds of issues. I think it's more complicated than that, although there's no doubt that when one reads the Synoptics and one reads the Gospel of John, one can see a difference of emphasis. In fact, I've written a book called Jesus According to Scripture, in which I first go through the Synoptic portrait as a whole and then come and pick up John and show where they tie together to try and make a better case for the historicity of the Gospel of John. And Craig Blomberg has recently written a book as well on the on historicity in the Gospel of John that also is very well done. An Aberdeen colleague of mine. Fifth, the authentic Jesus of the sayings and parables is not to be equated with the non-authentic Jesus of the kingdom and the return. Another feature of the Gospel of Thomas is that Jesus is what's called non-apocalyptic. He isn't looking for God to come and judge in a catastrophic way, in a way in line with Jewish expectation. This is the exact opposite of Albert Schweitzer's conclusion about the historical Jesus, who said that's what Jesus was all about. Anyway, their point is that Jesus, the Jesus who produced these sayings and parables, where these elements tend to be less demonstrable, is not the same as the non-authentic Jesus. Non-authentic means it doesn't go back to Jesus, isn't authentic with Jesus. The non-authentic Jesus of the kingdom and return. So if we get themes of kingdom and return, we know that's not really Jesus. It's called a non-apocalyptic Jesus. That's one of the results of the seminar. Again, many scholars, not just conservatives. You're going to hear me say this over and over again. A lot of times I'm going to say, not just conservatives, believe this portrait of the seminar is false. It's a false understanding of the historical Jesus.
Mm-hmm. We're just saying that this was a result of the seminar.
Yeah.
It's also premised.
Yeah, because they're premising it on, the premise of it to a degree is a result of this model. Okay? The question was, is this a result of the seminar or is it a premise? And I'm saying it's a premise because of the juxtaposition of Thomas and Mark and what Thomas tells us about the earliest Jesus. Or at least the alternative earliest Jesus. You've got to remember that for the seminar, the issue is there's not one Jesus portrait of Jesus out there. Okay? And so we've got to figure out what really goes back to him. And they opt to go the wisdom. Tom Wright talks about the Vredestrasse and the Schweitzerstrasse. Okay? And the Vredestrasse is the idea that Jesus was a teacher, that Mark is responsible for turning Jesus into the Messiah. The Schweitzerstrasse is the Strasse that says Jesus taught apocalyptic in apocalyptic Jewish terms. And Wright's position is that the Schweitzerstrasse has more truth to it than the Vredestrasse. The seminar is more a reflection of the Vredestrasse. Okay? A little German for our Tubingen friend. The burden of proof is to prove historicity. Okay? The seminar basically took the view that I had a conversation with Daryl Schmidt about this over dinner one night. We happened to be at a conference together and we had dinner together and we were talking about the work of the seminar and he said, I start off with the idea that a saying is black and it has to earn its way up the scale to get to red. Now, if you're with me, okay? So the burden of proof is to prove historicity. And many of the people working with the seminar were comfortable with that premise. Not all of them, but many of them. And remember, this is a conglomeration of people who are all over the map. So these premises reflect where many of the people were. Let me just make an aside about burden of proof. There's a lot of discussion today about burden of proof in all kinds of areas. It's my own feeling that the whole burden of proof debate is a huge rabbit trail. The burden of proof is on the person presenting the case. I don't think you can go into a discussion and say there is a burden of proof that lies with one side or the other before you go in. I think you have to make your case. And the burden of proof is on you as the presenter making a case to make that case. Oral tradition is fluid. Now, these are premises about which we would have questions. And you're going to listen to how I deal with this. Oral tradition is fluid. Okay, now the question is, how fluid? Okay, oral tradition might be fluid. It might be possible to paraphrase what Jesus said and still reflect what he said, that kind of thing. That's fluidity. Okay, but how fluid is it? That's the question. Is it possible to create sayings, to use a phrase that we like in relationship to Genesis, ex nihilo, okay, out of nothing? See, that's different than saying we're paraphrasing or we're explaining or we're elaborating what Jesus said or we're developing what Jesus implied. Different level of fluidity. So that one depends. Question is, how fluid? The oral mentality remembers, the claim is, the oral mentality remembers not the precise words, but the core of what was said. Okay? So this at least argues that in an oral context, we can get pretty close to what was said, but maybe not exactly what was said. And the answer here, I think, is sometimes but not always. We have Jewish examples of tradition being passed on where care about words is very important. For example, there's a very famous prayer in Judaism known as the 18 benedictions that was repeated daily. You learned it. It's much like we learn the Lord's Prayer by rote. Okay? And when you learn the Lord's Prayer by rote, you pretty much remember it the way you were taught it. And the only issue is, do we trespass or do we sin? You know, the two versions. Which version of the Lord's Prayer did you learn? Mark has arbitrarily arranged the events in his story of Jesus. Now, we're going to start to get to the subtleties of all this. And that is that history is more than mere chronological sequence. It can be topically covered. So the mere fact that there is rearrangement isn't necessarily a problem for historicity. I can decide, I'm going to tell you four miracle stories in a row. For example, there is a section in the gospel tradition where four miracle stories are told in a row. They begin with Jesus calming the sea. Then we have the Gerizim demoniac. Then we have the woman with the flow of blood. And then we have the raising of Jairus' daughter. Four right in a row. In two of the Gospels, they all appear together. But in one Gospel, we have two of them, then a series of events, and then the other two. Of course, one of them is a paired miracle, the hemorrhage and Jairus' daughter. So two of the Gospels have four in a row. Two of the Gospels have them separated by events. The question is, does that impact historicity? No, it impacts precision about chronology, but it doesn't necessarily impact historicity. So the idea that Mark has arbitrarily arranged the events in his story, and arbitrarily is a problematic word here, is the issue. Mark may well have done some arrangement. In fact, the other gospel writers may have done some arrangement as well, but shifting of sequence in and of itself is not an argument against historicity. In fact, in Luke's gospel, it's likely that the scene where Jesus appears in the synagogue in Luke 4 has been moved up in ministry to introduce the section on Galilean ministry to, in effect, say, this is what Jesus' ministry in Galilee was like. How do we know that that's likely been moved? Because in the midst of that unit, there's a discussion about performing the miracles here that you performed in Capernaum, only there's one small problem. In Luke, at that point, Jesus hasn't been to Capernaum yet. He's at Capernaum in the next scene. So that's a clue that likely this scene has been moved forward as a type scene for the entire unit. So yes, there is arrangement in the events of the story of Jesus in the Gospels, more than likely, but it's not arbitrary. Nor does it impact historicity.
Dan,
yes?
With those ones where it seems to be arranged more topically, are there situations where the Gospels still say immediately after this he went and did that?
The question is whether there is an impression about whether or not there's a sequence involved. I think in most cases, no, that the connecting term is often and. Okay, this is something that is discussed in terms of the way the arrangement goes. But usually where we've got pericope that have been moved around in the parallels, we're dealing with just a simple link word. Our tendency is to assume chronology because chronology is very important in the West. Okay? But it's not necessarily important to an ancient.
Mm-hmm. Do they mean arbitrarily in such a loaded way as it sounds? Do they really mean that Mark has just jumbled it together without any thought?
I think they mean it in such a way that the arrangement is, to some degree, is artificial. Okay? So to that extent, the term is loaded. So that you can't deduce anything about the historical Jesus from the way the events are juxtaposed to one another. My point would be, if you really study this carefully, you can in some cases tell that it's been topically arranged, and so there are certain judgments you don't make about the relationship of the units. Jesus' disciples were oral and itinerant. They moved around, revised, slash, created his sayings and parables as the situation demanded. And so the question becomes, are the options only revision and creation? What of explanation? What of paraphrase? What of elaboration, if you will? Now, I do think that if you work with a synopsis, everybody knows what a synopsis is. That's where you put the words of a text in parallel columns so you can see what the exact wording is of the various Gospels vis-a-vis one another. There are coloring schemes that go with this. For those who really work with it carefully, I have a synopsis at home that barely is still together. Okay, it can never come apart. Okay, because I've colored the whole thing. Okay, I can't lose it. And I've actually transferred a lot of that stuff onto my computer so that I have a computer record. So should it come apart, I won't go and pull out my hair and end up with my hairline. Okay, so but it's when you look at these parallels that you see that you're dealing with this phenomenon, and the phenomena is the juxtaposition of similarity and diversity, which is always the key to working with the Gospels. You have certain things that are similar between the Gospels. You have certain things that are dissimilar between the Gospels, including wording. Including wording in certain contexts. And we're going to look at some examples in just a second. This has to be dealt with when you deal with questions about the historical Jesus. Q and Thomas were composed during the period of 50 to 60 A.D. This premise suggests, in fact, that Q also belongs earlier in this mix than I suggested earlier. Mark was written about A.D. 70. See, now what this model does, this is the radical model. What this model does, as I've stated it here, where you've got Q, Thomas, and then Mark, is that your saying Gospels come first, and your wisdom Jesus comes first. Matthew was composed about 85. Luke and Acts was created about around 90. And then John is in the same period. Those dates, for the most part, are late. Well, they're late for the Synoptic Gospels, and they're early for not so much Q, but Thomas. And then the importance that's given to Thomas as a result. Yeah.
Darrell, just a real quick yes or no. A lot of scholars are questioning whether or not there's even a Q now, especially among conservatives, it seems like. I'm just curious what your position is on that.
I've already stated it. I think Q exists. And I think that the questioning of Q is very problematic. I think it's very hard to argue that Matthew is the first gospel. It's very hard to argue that Matthew is the first gospel and Mark is a summarizing gospel, which is what normally happens. Because normally the order becomes Matthew, then Luke, then Mark. Okay? And Mark is seen as kind of a Reader's Digest summarizing gospel. The reason I think that's difficult is because if you look at the way Matthew begins, or you look at some of the content of Matthew with the speeches, like the Sermon on the Mount or whatever, if that came first and Mark is summarizing, how do we not get some infancy material? How do we not get some indication of something out of the Sermon on the Mount? So I just find that very, very difficult. The one thing that the Matthean prioritists have going for them is the testimony of church history. But Matthew was very quickly received as the most widespread, widely circulated of the synoptic gospels. It and John were the two major gospels in the early centuries. And Mark and Luke played a lesser role. And because of the Hebrew connections that Matthew has, it was natural to think that Matthew would be the first gospel coming out of a Hebrew context. Okay? But the problem that I have is I don't think that Matthew and Luke know each other, and yet there are 200 verses of overlap. So the question is, where does that come from? I think the simplest answer is Q, or something like Q. Now, I've written an article on Q in great detail, and it so happens that Q itself is quite complex. There's about a third of it that is virtually word for word between the two versions. There's another third of it that's very close, where you just got minor changes. And there's another third of it that's all over the map in terms of being close. So I actually don't think Q is a written document that they have shared. I think it's part of the church tradition that exists in this largely oral form, okay, that explains some of the differences. And some of the one-third, the outer one-third of Q, may have nothing to do with Q at all. May just be independent tradition. Okay, let's talk about examples of variety and core. And I just raised these for your attention. Many of these will be familiar to you, but they highlight the nature of the problem. The temptation in the wilderness. Which account represents the actual order of events? Okay, I raise this to make this point. It's very popular in the United States for some conservatives to say we shouldn't have anything to do with the historical critical method and we shouldn't have anything to do with the historical Jesus. It's all packed with problematic presuppositions, many of which I've stated for you, and so it's just too dangerous and too problematic to go into. We should avoid it, period. My response is everybody has to do work on the historical Jesus, no matter how conservative they are, because of the nature of the material in the Bible itself. And these are some of the examples I point out to make the point. The temptations are not told in the same order in the two Gospels where they appear. As you all know, there's bread, there's temple, and there is, what's the third one? Bread, temple, kingdoms, bread, temple, and kingdoms. That's right, I'll offer you the world. Okay, and in one of them they're in that order, and in Luke the order is switched so that the temple comes last. Okay, so if you ask the historical question in the temptations, what's the order? Everybody has to do historical Jesus work. Everyone has to sit back and say, it's clear that one of these, right, unless you're going to attempt to argue, and you're still doing historical Jesus work if you argue this, there were two sets of three, and they came in one order the first time and another order the second, which seems to belabor the issue, so I don't think that's likely. But you might try and get out. So both of us are giving us a true picture, but they're each giving us half. Okay, that's still historical Jesus work. Okay, so everybody does it. It's the degree to which it is done and the manner in which it is done that is the issue. So that's the first example. Second example, the baptism of Jesus. What is it that the voice said when Jesus was baptized, and was this a public or private event? Okay, and those of you who study this in detail may well be aware that in Mark, it's very clearly stated that this event seems to be very private between the Father and Jesus. More importantly are the words that come from heaven. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. That's Matthew. You are my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. That is Mark and Luke. So again, the question is, if we're going to ask what the exact words... Now, this isn't a problem with the historical Jesus, but it's an analogy. If we're going to ask what was said by the voice from heaven, which I think we would all take to be a divine voice of one kind or another, okay? Did he say this or did he say you? Now, again, one of the solutions might be, and I know people who argue this, he said both, and each gospel writer chose one. In fact, there is an extra biblical gospel that takes this solution. And if you look in your text critical index, in your text critical apparatus of your New Testament text, you will see that reading in the Gospel of the Ebionites. Okay? So that's one way to try and solve the problem. You're still doing historical Jesus work. More importantly, I think, is to analyze, well, perhaps what's going on is this. This was a private experience which God, the voice from heaven, addressed to Jesus directly as an imprimatur of what he was saying. The Gospel of John tells us that John saw this as well, so it wasn't completely private, but everyone around didn't see it. That's the point. And, not only that, what Matthew does is to paraphrase it and give its historical significance, which is still historical. God was saying at that moment, this is my Son. Okay? Even though he said it with the words, you are my Son. Okay? Thus you can get variation in fluidity, You still have historicity. It's harmonization, which some people don't like, but I think is perfectly legitimate because I think we do this historically all the time. Sometimes we quote someone, sometimes we summarize them. I often use this illustration in talking about this. You're riding along in your car and you get the 5-minute news summary. Okay, what's beautiful about this illustration is it works in the United States and I know it works in Germany. Okay, because in Germany at the top of the hour, there's a 5-minute news summary, at least in Baden-Württemberg, Eins, there's a 5-minute news summary at the top of every hour. Okay, and we get the same thing in the United States. Let's assume that George W. Bush gets up and gives an hour-long speech. The person editing that report or that speech has a choice. He can say either, President George Bush addressed Congress today and he said, and run a clip, run an audio clip. Quote him directly. Or you can say, President Bush told Congress today we must have more money to fight the war in Iraq. Now, that exact sentence may not appear anywhere in that speech, but that sentence may well be a very accurate historical summary of what George Bush said and what George Bush's intent was in addressing the Congress. And no one would go, unhistorical, unhistorical, because you didn't quote him. As long as the summary was accurate, okay, it would still be seen as historical. So the idea of gospel writers paraphrasing or explaining or elaborating intent, it seems to me, is not a big issue here. The third example, Peter's confession at Caesarea Philippi. This is a big moment. Okay, Jesus asks, who do you say that I am? You are the Christ. You are the Christ of God. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Okay, those are the three replies in the synoptics. They're not all exactly the same, although the point in all three of them is the same. Obviously, someone's done some editing, or the tradition that they received had done some editing. The point was the confession about Jesus being the Christ, in contrast to what everyone else thought of him as a prophet. That's the point. But there are variations. Again, doing historical Jesus work, if you're wrestling what exactly did Jesus say, you'd have to make a judgment about how you think the relationship of those three versions works out. Has someone summarized and simplified, or has someone expanded and elaborated? Those would be your options. Yes?
Am I right in saying in the original there's no quotation marks either? So in a newspaper,
yes,
if you want to write, President Bush said,
yes,
money,
yes,
quotation marks around,
right,
it, then it, and he hadn't actually used that quote, that would be not fair, but because he hadn't, that wasn't a quote from him, although it might be an accurate summary. But in the New Testament Gospels, there aren't quotation marks.
Okay, the question is whether there are quotation marks in the original, in the Greek. The way Greek tends to deal with quotation marks is the answer. The way Greek tends to deal with quotation marks is to put things either in direct or sometimes indirect discourse, which is the same kind of effect, but again, I think because we're in an oral culture, we have to be careful not to think of them in the quotation marks like we do. This is, whenever someone comes into a oral exam for me, for PhD program, it's an entrance exam, I have one question I always ask them to see where they are on the Gospels. And the question is, what do you think of the red letter Bible? Evaluate the red letter Bible for me theologically. Okay? And I want to hear them talk about the red letters. I want them to hear them talk about the distinction between the red letters and the black in the Word of God. You know, and those kinds of questions to think through what the relationship is. Part of what we are dealing with in this problem, the red letter Bible was the creation of people who somehow wanted to say the words of Jesus were more important than the rest of the Bible. And it also was a reflection of the fact that somehow the quoted exact words of Jesus are what really count. And I think we have to be careful with that. The trial of Jesus before his Jewish leadership is another case where there was variation. There was variation in the questions and in the sequencing of those questions when he was asked about whether he was the Christ, whether he was the Son of God. And there is some variation in the key reply. The difference is, I am, Mark, I am and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the Father, coming on the clouds of heaven. Matthew begins, it isn't from now on. Therefore, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the Father and coming on the clouds. And Luke has, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the Father. Doesn't mention the coming of the clouds at all. Okay? Again, variation. You'd have to ask about it if you were doing historical Jesus work. And there clearly is something going on here, but it's not exact. I had six examples in the outline. I'm only using four because I'm running out of time and I want to be sure to have time for questions. Let's talk about, now I'm shifting gears on you. I've introduced the problem. The results of the Jesus Seminar's deliberations. What was their product like when it came to the actual words of Jesus? Here we go. This is for the canonical Gospels as a whole. Less than 3% were in red. That's exactly Jesus. 14% were in pink. So 17%, pretty close to Jesus. Okay? 20% in gray. So that's 37% that might go back to Jesus in one way or another. You can do the math. The remaining 63% are black. 63% has nothing to do with Jesus. That's almost two-thirds. Mark. Okay, well now we'll go a gospel at a time. Nothing's in red. That's unbelievable for the earliest gospel. Okay, that tells you something's up. 11% in pink, 30% in gray, remaining 59% in black. Luke, I was particularly interested in this, 4% in red, 23% in pink, so that's 27% as a whole, another 22%, so almost half of Luke could in some way go back to Jesus. That's actually the highest rated gospel so far, which is, I guess, nice to know. And then 51% black.
Darryl, sorry, can you just give us the gray and black from Mark again?
Yeah, I'll go back. Sorry. Are these not on your handout?
No.
Okay, sorry. 30% gray for Mark, 59% black.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, sorry. Go through Luke again real quick. They'll all be the same. So 4% red, 23% pink, 22% gray, 51% black. Okay? Thomas. Okay? Thomas. 2% red, 27% pink, 20% gray. So it's neck and neck between Thomas and Luke, okay, for who has the most material going back to Jesus. 51% in black. John, nothing in red. 444 in pink. Okay, this is another way to say not much. 216A, 12, 24, and 25, 13, 20 in gray. Okay.
I mean, that's the one verse.
Everything else is in black, yes. Virtually nothing in the Gospel of John goes back to Jesus. Okay, I'll leave that up for a second so you can copy. Okay? You want to go back? Okay, sure, sorry. Yes.
3 minutes
till the tape runs out. Okay, we'll take a client a pausa, okay, and let you switch when the time comes. Okay, this is another way to chart this out. Red, pink, gray, and black. I have a colleague of mine and I who worked on this together, and he is a math freak. So that's why we've got all these charts and stuff in here. Plus, he likes to play with his computer. There's the red. Okay, you can't see it in Mark and can't see it in John. Pink, gray, black. Okay, I think you got the point.
What's the scale down?
Sorry? The number of verses that are involved. okay? The number of verses that are involved, okay? This is another way to chart the same thing. He's just having fun. Okay, what do we say about the methods and results of the Jesus Seminar? And maybe this is a good place to take our break because it's a natural break. So we'll let him switch the tape and then we'll pick up.
Is there coffee outside?
Is there coffee outside? I have no idea. I'm... Yeah, half past, we're done.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. John is in brackets, 444. This is Jesus said there's no prophet without honor his own name.
Yeah, and the reason, the observation is being made that 444 is Jesus said there's no prophet without honor in his country, and that's because it's multiply attested. See, that remark is also in Mark, or it's also in Luke. Okay, in the synagogue scene that we talked about. And there are variations of it, I think, in the other Gospels as well. So that's why it's accepted as being.
I just got my NRSV. Why is it in brackets? Is it a variant?
I don't know. You mean why is the verse in brackets in John?
In the NRSV.
I don't know the answer. I couldn't answer that question without looking at a textual apparatus.
It's just an aside.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's in... Yes, exactly. That's what it is. It's not that it's textually problematic. It's a parenthetical remark, a summary of something Jesus said in the story. Okay. What should we say?
Sorry, General, but that's not even meant to be the words that Jesus is
saying. It is indirectly because it's still a report of something that Jesus said. And so it's still attributed to Jesus indirectly. It's not designed to be in quotation marks, but it's indirect discourse and as such it counts. Okay, evaluation. Here's the Jesus of the seminar. Here are the summary conclusions in terms of his mission and message. He had no mission with the 12. He did not predict his suffering. He performed no miracles to draw attention. That's the naturalist supposition coming out. He did not judge. He did not make messianic or personal claims. All this in contrast to the portrait of Jesus in the Gospels.
Is he thought to have performed any miracles at all?
No. In fact, any time you have a saying attached to a miracle in the Jesus Seminar, almost without exception, unless that saying appears in a non-miraculous context somewhere else, it's automatically black.
Do you have a summary of what they believe he did say?
Yeah, he's a teacher of wisdom. He tells us to seek after God, to ask, and it will be received. To give unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, those kinds of things. Here's Richard Hayes, Duke University. Now, Richard Hayes is, there are various ways to speak about Richard Hayes. Some people say he's an evangelical, some people say he's not, which is a nice way to say he operates on the edge of American evangelicalism. But he wrote a review of the five Gospels, which didn't take so much his own view as it did summarize the view of other New Testament scholars, and he complained about the seminar at various levels. This is one thing that he said. In theory, the project could produce an interesting freeze-frame shot of the status of gospel scholarship near the end of the 20th century. Not exactly the epic-making scientific breakthrough of a Galileo. The comparison in the front introduction to the five Gospels is this is a Galilean-like project, but a modestly worthwhile survey of opinion. And it's actually a cross-section of a certain section of opinion. Here are the major problems. The self-selected group of researchers, which constitutes the Jesus Seminar, though it includes several fine scholars who have written in New Testament areas, does not represent a balanced cross-section of current scholarly opinion. That's Richard Hayes. That's not me saying that. Okay? He complained. There were no scholars from Princeton. There were no scholars from... other key New Testament schools, they tended to concentrate on Harvard and Claremont. Okay, so it was only a select band. So this isn't... How can you say you represent New Testament scholarship when the selected group is imbalanced? That's what he's saying. Second, The selection and dating of sources is a major problem, especially the valuing of the Gospel of Thomas as an early independent source for Jesus' tradition. That complaint also was echoed in Richard Hayes' review. Robert Grant, who taught history at the University of Chicago, also complained about this. Taught church history at the University of Chicago. Three, another major problem is the seminar's dominant use of the criteria of dissimilarity for assessing the authenticity of the Jesus tradition. Now I need to explain to you what the criteria of dissimilarity is for those of you who either don't know or don't recall. Dissimilarity argues that if what Jesus taught is unlike Judaism and is unlike the early church, it's dissimilar to both the past and the future, then it goes back to Jesus. This actually is, for all that's been said about it, a good criteria. It's good in the sense that it shows you what's distinctive about Jesus. But it also produces a very minimalist Jesus. It's a Jesus detached from his past and his roots, and it's a Jesus detached from what came out of Jesus' ministry. That's unrealistic. But there's an excessive use of dissimilarity by the tradition. Here's the premise restated. Everything that is authentic must be dissimilar to both Judaism and Christianity. Tom Wright of Britain has restated this in a more nuanced form that I think has a little more value. And basically his statement of this criteria is, everything that is not completely like Judaism of the past or completely like the early church may well go back to Jesus. It's called double dissimilarity. And the point that he's making is, if Jesus is the bridge between Judaism and the church, maybe we can see that in the way the tradition is, around him is reflected. That will reflect perhaps some difference with Judaism looking back, but some connection, and some difference with the early church looking forward, but again, some connection. That's a more nuanced view of this criteria, which is debated in New Testament circles as to its value. Fourth, the Jesus Seminar's insistence on finding a non-eschatological or a non-apocalyptic Jesus. We've already talked about this one. Jesus himself did not proclaim a message of God's future intervention in history, a final kingdom, nor is the kingdom a major theme. The major problem with this, although it's all a problem, but the major problem is this last point. Most historical Jesus scholars believe that the major theme of Jesus' teaching that we can absolutely be sure about as historical Jesus scholars is that he taught about the kingdom of God. The assessment of Jesus' sayings in isolation from a more comprehensive reconstruction of the events of his life, ministry, death, and resurrection is methodologically problematic and leads to a Jesus whose character does not fit the events we know took place. This is what I call the divide and conquer strategy of historical criticism. It takes each event as an individual unit by itself, one at a time, analyzing it, completely detached from the sequencing of other events. No one works with history this way. History is about sequence and impact. And so, to detach these events and take them on one at a time, separate from one another, is methodologically problematic. What's even more interesting is that if we do this and we end up with the Jesus with the traits that the Jesus Seminar has, it's very hard to conceive of why Jesus would have been crucified. Why we had a death and a resurrection. If there's no 12 going on the mission, if he's not talking about a kingdom of God, if he's just saying a few things that are socially offensive, and there's no real crowd around him, then what's all the bother? Sixth, the seminar has a minimalist, socially concerned Jesus, even a naturalist Jesus, who was offensive in his social claims, but really was not unique in his religious teaching. There's no reason for him to have really been remembered in a significant way or to ever have been elevated to the kind of status that the early church elevated him to. That's the most, I think, interesting point. If Jesus is as benign as the Jesus Seminar suggests, how did it come to be that Jewish people ended up worshiping this Jesus? Could such a Jesus generate a fresh religious movement? It might have been a political movement, But it certainly wouldn't have been a religious movement, which is what it became. The seminar suffers from a limited view of the perspectival nature of history and sayings. Now I'm entering into the most difficult part of our hour. I want to talk about a perspectival view of history. And I'm going to use an illustration to do it, because it's the only way I know how to do this. But it will show you, I think, the problem that we have in the nature of history. And I'm going to try three quick examples. Here's the first one. Anyone know what the original name for... For the European War in the second decade of the 20th century was. Okay? How is that for a convoluted way to say it? What was the...
The Great War.
Okay? What do we call it today?
First World War.
Why do we call it the First World War?
Second.
Exactly right. Okay? Now, would it be a distortion of history to describe the events of the Great War and call them World War One?
Yeah, but unless you were claiming to be somebody writing in 1925. Exactly right.
So here's the point about perspectivalism. Point about perspectivalism is sometimes the significance of an event or an importance of an event or working out of an event isn't seen until subsequent events take place. So why do we have World War I? We have World War I because we have World War II. Did World War I lead into World War II? It sure did. Ask Hitler. Okay. Why did we get the Nationalist Socialist Party in reaction to the Versailles Treaty? Okay, so they're interconnected. Another example of the same thing. And in class, I do it this way. At this point in class, what I do is I take a clip of the movie Tora, Tora, Tora. Anyone know what the movie Tora, Tora, Tora is about? It's a movie about the secret attack of the Japanese on Pearl Harbor. Okay, it was a joint American-Japanese movie production. Okay, done in the 70s. That's why I know about it. Some of you look like you may have been playing with sandcastles in the 70s. Anyway, I play this clip, and this clip has the day Pearl Harbor is attacked, and the Japanese fighters are coming back to the ship, and they're all elated. They're all elated because the attack was a surprise. It did devastating damage. And I think the whole thing's been a success, except for one general. They tell one general that the ship they were most interested in catching in port was not there. And he says this. He says, "I'm afraid that all we have done is to anger the American lion or tiger." It's something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing. Okay, remember the line? Now, what this shows is the levels within an event in history. If I reported that the Japanese felt that they had had a terrific success on the day of Pearl Harbor, would that be true? One level it would be true. And for many of the fighters who flew the mission, they would have said, "Our mission was a success. We did a lot of damage. We caught the U.S. by surprise. We devastated their Navy in the Pacific area. But if I said... some people saw within that victory a real problem, that would also be true. Now, let's assume I had two different reports, one of which said this was a victory, the other of which said there was a problem inherent in the victory. Would either of those reports be unhistorical? No. That's the point of the illustration. It's the perspective of history that lets us know that the concern that the general had on the day was a real live concern that ended up playing itself out. Another example, final one, this one from sports. My team is the Houston Rockets. I lived in Houston, Texas. And if you know anything about Houston sports history, which most of you wouldn't because you're from Europe, okay, it is that Houston never wins. Okay, so there probably is an equivalent over here. Okay, it's like the difference between Bayern Munich and Munich 1860. Okay, I think 1860's won once or twice or something like that. Not very often. Anyway, the basketball playoffs in the United States are a best of seven. Okay, the first one to win four moves on. The team with the best record during the year has home court advantage, which is really an advantage in the playoffs. During the playoffs, when Houston won its first championship, in the semifinal round, they met Phoenix and lost the first two home games. Okay, devastating. Go down 0-2, lose the first two home games. In the history of the NBA, decades of playoffs, only one team had ever come back from that deficit to win a playoff series, to lose the first two games at home and go on and win the series. It's now happened three times. Happened against Houston this year. Anyway, typical. Anyway, so at the end of the second game in the locker room, the Houston players say, "This game is a wake-up call for us." Now, when he said it at the time in the locker room, it was a statement said of dejection because they had blown two home games against Phoenix. The series goes on, and it just so happens that Houston becomes the second team to win a series, having lost the first two home games. At the end of the seventh game, the saying is repeated, "Game two was a wake-up call for our team." But the emotion associated with it, everything that it means, has shifted significantly because of what has taken place subsequently. Now, my point is, the perspectival view of history tells you both a pessimistic statement and an optimistic statement of the same words are both historical and have a historical context and have historical value. And in one sense, that game as a wake-up call is more true having won the series after Game 7 than it is in the uncertainty of having lost the first two games at the start. My argument would be the impact of the cross, the impact of the resurrection, is a similar kind of experience for the disciples, in which they went through a period of dejection and disappointment with what happened and then were able to reflect back on it after the victory, in which everything that was said was still true but now had whole waves of additional significance as a result. That's perspectival history, and the Gospels are written, I think. I don't think they wipe out the perspectivalness of that history when they're produced. That's my point. I think that explains some of the variation that we have. Subsequent events can reshape sayings in history without reflecting a distortion of that history or saying. That's the point. Subsequent events can reshape sayings in history without reflecting a distortion of that history or saying. Sayings can summarize and still be historical. We do it all the time today. My five-minute news summary examples fit here. So there is, interestingly enough, despite the claim of being the historical critical method, a too narrow view of history and historicity in the Jesus Seminar. That's the point that I'm making. Eight, the historical Jesus is still seen in sayings that may be rated pink or gray. The voice of Jesus versus the very words of Jesus. Some conservatives will make a distinction between the vox Jesu, the voice of Jesus, and the verba Jesu, the very words of Jesus. Both reflect the historical Jesus. That's important. That's an important distinction. The amount of sayings the seminar puts in black is suspect, and it often operates on hidden premises. For example, the Son of Man. The Son of Man meets the historical critical criteria for being authentic and going back to Jesus, because the Son of Man tradition is attributed in all the layers of the gospel tradition. It's in every layer. Okay? That's called multiple attestation. So it should be accepted. But what they do is they cut it up. There is the earthly Son of Man sayings, the suffering Son of Man sayings, and the apocalyptic Son of Man sayings to try and cut up that multiple attestation. Divide and conquer. Okay? That's the effect. And so, but what's really going on is, I think, that they're trying to find a way to get rid of the Christology that's in the Son of Man sayings. Because if the Son of Man sayings are authentic, if the only thing authentic in the Gospels is the Son of Man sayings, you've got a high Christology. Okay? So it's important to discredit this layer of tradition, because if you have it, You've got a very high view of Jesus. This is Jesus appealing to the language of Daniel 7. This is the Son of Man riding the clouds, which is something only God does, coming to the Ancient of Days. This is someone with judgment authority. See? Can't have it. No way. So I think it's excluded on theological grounds, and some of the sayings are tied to miracles, so they're excluded for that reason. Here's what Tom Wright has to say about the seminar, and I wish I could do this in a good British accent to really bring it across, but I can't. But you all know what a British accent sounds like. So, what is a foot? Only a person from the UK would use that word, okay? What is a foot? Anyway, what is a foot is not the detailed objective study of individual passages leading to a new view of Jesus and the early church. It is a particular view of Jesus and the early church working its way through into a detailed list of sayings that fit with this view. He's saying what they did is they had a view of Jesus and they projected it all back into the Jesus tradition. I think he's right. What difference does it make? Well, at one level we can say, when you're talking with the most skeptical who don't even think Jesus existed historically, etc., at least the Jesus Seminar came up with some authentic words from Jesus and they think he really existed. Okay, so when you meet the super radical, okay, you can say, even the liberal Jesus Seminar knows that Jesus existed. Okay, at the same time, the wedge is firmly driven between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith, which I think and I've expressed as a problem. The seminar offers an attempt to explain who Jesus is that is representative of where many who study him are. This, I think, is the big issue theologically. I think most people who are trying to undercut Jesus today in the public square want to turn him either into a great moral teacher, a Galilean rabbi, or a social activist. Make him an exemplary figure at a social, political level, but don't make him a unique religious figure. A unique Jesus messes things up. The Jesus Seminar does not represent a cross-section of modern New Testament scholarship. One has only to look at the reaction of moderates to see this. It also is an example of what we call the second quest. Those of you who know the history of the study of the historical Jesus know that there are three quests. The original quest that comes out of the Enlightenment, that was a naturalist, a portrait of a naturalist Jesus trying to take out all the dogmatic elements on theological grounds. The second quest, rooted largely in a Greco-Roman context and saying the early church is responsible for a lot of who Jesus is, what is said about Jesus in the Gospels. And the third quest, coming out of a Jewish context, it's actually the most fruitful of the three quests and has the most potential. And many evangelicals are participating in the third quest. The seminar's view tends to be radical, skeptical, and cynical. There is an alternative to the seminar's view of who Jesus is. There is an alternative represented by works like Jesus Under Fire, which I know you all have been exposed to. Jesus the Messiah, work by Bob Stein. Jesus According to Scripture, which is a work I did. Jesus and the Kingdom of God, which is a book by Beasley Murray. And numerous other monographs, as well as the IBR Jesus Project. The IBR Jesus Project is a group of Jesus scholars in the Institute for Biblical Research. These are American and continental evangelicals, continental to a degree. We've got Howard Marshall participating. And basically, we have isolated 12 events we think we can defend on historical critical grounds, on the critics' criteria, and defend their historicity. Putting those 12 bents together, we think we can present a core of what Jesus' ministry was about and make a case for the historical Jesus. We're doing one event a year until all 12 are done. Each event is put into a periodical article. When it's all done, we'll put the whole thing together into a book. We're about halfway. We're meeting in 1 month in Tübingen in my apartment because I co-convene this with Bob Webb. And we're going to do three events because we missed last year. And get caught up, and in 2 years we'll be done. And the whole thing will be out. There'll be a book that will be a technical book for scholars. There'll be a book that will be a popular book for the average layperson to get their hands on. So there is an alternative. The debate is important because it is the difference between a domesticated Jesus and the Jesus who claims to show the way to God and provide access to him in the context of hope and forgiveness. It is a moral Jesus, the religious teacher, versus a unique Jesus who brings God's blessing, forgiveness, and hope. So there's a lot at stake here. That's why it's important. That's why the historical Jesus debate is important. And with that, I am done, and I have 25 seconds. Evaluation forms are coming to you. Thanks.
Can I just ask about,
sure.
The people who are on the seminar.
Yes.
Do they have to agree with the list of whatever it was?
No.
No. So who drew up the seven?
The major people associated with organizing the seminar.
Right.
Okay.
How many?
Well, you're probably talking about there's probably a group, I don't know exactly, but my guess it would be a half dozen, 12. But the bulk of the seminar participants, I think, would reflect the premises. But it was an open invitation forum, and so it was whoever showed up. It just happened that there were a lot of people showing up who held this view. You know, it's interesting, one of the associates is Paul Verhoeven, who is a Hollywood director, directed several movies. I thought I saw another question. Yes.
How big is their impact?
How big is the impact? The impact is it was all over the public square in the early 90s. There have been numerous specials produced for cable TV niche markets over the last 10 years that reflect what the seminar holds. So there's a lot of visibility. What's interesting is in the scholarly community, it was kind of met with a because one, not just conservatives, but moderates weren't happy with it. And secondly, because there wasn't anything new or earth-shattering that came out of it. It was just a way of hitting the public square. So a lot of lay people are aware of it, okay? And in conservative circles, there are a lot of lay people who don't know how to respond to it. So at that level, it's had some impact. It's made almost no impact at all in Europe. And one of the great fun things I love to do is to come over here and talk to people about the Jesus seminar and then watch the laughs that come as a result. There's a very much a dismissive attitude towards it here. But it certainly made a public impact, and certain strands of what they are teaching are now showing up all over the place. This role of Thomas, the idea of alternative Christianities, etc., is all over the place. It's in books that are coming out even now.
Da Vinci Code
is a reflection of it as well. Yes, question.
One of the places where I found most of it was coming from Muslims doing apologetics.
Yes, exactly.
It's just a great model of Jesus to attack you with, and to say that here are Christian scholars who are showing.
Yes, and is and in Islamic discussions, the Islamic community loves to bring out the differences in the Gospels as a way of getting you off track. So all this is very important to have your people be somewhat aware of. Another observation?
I was wondering whether in America that approach and methodology hasn't drawn any ridicule, because I find it so peculiar that this voting procedure kind of democratic way to the reliability of certain passages without taking into consideration literary structures or philosophical principles.
Yes, there have been some people who... The question is whether the way of going about this with the voting, etc., has been ridiculed. There have been people who've challenged not only the way the voting has been done in this kind of democratic way, but even the mathematics of how the means were determined, etc. There's been some criticism at that level as well. But the most important thing is the sample, the sample scholars. It's not representative. And so that distorts everything. Well, I thank you all for your patience and your engagement, and I trust this has been of some value to you. Thanks.
Very good.